Law is Cool Podcast, Episode 17. Hello, and welcome to the Law is Cool Podcast. My name is Devin Johnston. If you've been following blogs and magazines for the past year, you're probably aware of a controversy that's been brewing about the role of federal and provincial human rights commissions in Canada. It all started in 2005 when a group of Osgoode Hall law students read a series of articles in Maclean's magazine. The students felt that the articles cast Muslims in a negative light that promoted dangerous stereotypes. Frustrated, the students asked Maclean's to print a 5,000-word rebuttal. After being turned down by the editor-in-chief, the students filed a human rights complaint against the magazine with the Ontario Human Rights Commission. That complaint, as well as similar ones filed in British Columbia and with the Canadian Human Rights Commission, have since sparked a media firestorm. Several journalists and media outlets, notably led by Mark Stein and Ezra Levant, have called human rights commissions into question, claiming that they're creating a chilling effect on free speech. With the support of many of Canada's major media outlets, the issue came to the attention of federal politicians. Liberal MP Keith Martin, for example, called for the repeal of hate speech provisions in human rights law. A war of words has erupted in the blogosphere, and, to top it all off, death threats have been received by many prominent figures on both sides of the debate. On today's show, Omar Haredi of the University of Western Ontario tries to get beyond the spin to find out how human rights commissions really work by interviewing two experienced human rights lawyers. First up is Pearl Eliadis, a Montreal-based human rights lawyer. She recently wrote an article called The Controversy Entrepreneurs in Montreal's English-language magazine Maisonneuve. She argues that the media coverage of this controversy has been unbalanced and attempts to correct some of the common myths and misconceptions about human rights commissions. Let's listen in.
All right, so to start with, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
My name is Pearl Eliadis. I'm a human rights lawyer. I work out of Montreal, but most of my practice is international.
Okay, and can you tell us a little bit about what the article is about?
I have worked in human rights commissions in the past. I've also worked against them, and my practice doesn't really involve human rights commissions in Canada anymore. I think in the last 4 or 5 years, I've only had one case involving a human rights commission. But
okay.
I've come back to Canada, so to speak, on this issue because I think that the way in which the Maclean's cases have been spun by the media have been seriously inaccurate. I think Canadians are being lied to. And so I was looking for a venue, and because of the length, it had to be a magazine that would publish something that would start to rebut some of the inaccuracies that are being put out there, unfortunately, by media who are in part controlled by magazines and newspapers who themselves have now had libel or other types of proceedings brought against them in connection with some of these issues.
And you mentioned, I believe it was seven specific lies that you said. Was it seven?
There are seven specific issues that are raised by the media that are being put out there as sort of fact or almost sort of hypotheses, and they're simply either untrue or they're partially true, and even where they are true, it's been seriously miscast again by the media, by elements of media. I shouldn't generalize. There are media out there who are trying to do a good job on this, but unfortunately the dominant voices have drowned out the others.
Now, would you say that there's a tension going on here between human rights and free speech by journalists, or is that really like a mischaracterization by some of the media?
Well, I mean, clearly, a number of members of the media are trying to characterize it in that way. So I think that's just an accurate fact.
Okay.
The problem with that characterization or that split is that free speech and freedom of expression are actually part of the human rights panoply of rights. The free speech, equality rights, these are all part of what we at a broad level call human rights.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't start picking and choosing your rights depending on which one, you know, serves your own interests professionally. So one of the things I've been trying to educate the media on is this notion that freedom of speech somehow trumps all other rights. That's not accurate. It's not reflected in our charter. Section 1 of our charter clearly states that there's a balancing act that has to take place with virtually all the rights
mm-hmm.
contained in charter. And I don't think many members of the media know that. And so that's why I think organizations like yours and blogs like yours perform a really important function.
Well, we do try to provide a third voice, or at least a more balanced voice. And I think in the piece that you mentioned, you referred to one of the complainants who dropped out, and he is a member of our site. So we've had to deal firsthand with a lot of these issues. Now,
that's interesting. I didn't know that.
Oh, okay. Yeah, he was actually he's actually one of our contributors, and so as a result, we received a great deal of hate mail and controversy as well on our site from I guess you could say the opposing side. But we really have tried to maintain a more of a balanced or neutral position. I am curious about your work abroad as well, because a lot of the issues that are coming up with free speech here do have to do with international issues and Canadian values versus values abroad. But you're very much involved in human rights internationally, it seems like. And is Canada still a model for human rights overseas? And if so, how do these issues play out in that respect?
Well, that's a very loaded question. I guess the answer is going to play out at a few levels if you'll permit me.
Okay.
The first one is that I want to point out that Reporters Without Borders just issued its annual report on freedom of speech around the world
mm-hmm.
for this year, and it just came out. So of course it includes the McLean's Stein. Issues and coverage. And despite, I would even argue, because of those events, Canada ranked 13th in the world, and I would point out that it ranks ahead of the United States and ahead of the United Kingdom this year. So I think when people talk about the fact that there's been some kind of a chilling effect on speech, it's important to remember that the laws we're talking about that the media have suddenly woken up to, 50 years later and realized are in statute books have been around for half a century. They have created an environment in Canada which is among the best in the world and which is among the documented by an organization like Reporters Without Borders as being among the freest in the world. So
mm-hmm.
I think that's an important backdrop to your question. The second piece I think is worth noting is that one of the, I think, more troubling aspects of the McLean-Stein debacle, and particularly the so-called McLean's three, the students who, initially the four, as you mentioned, and now the three who sort of stayed the course on the complaint. One of the things that was extremely troubling about that is that those three students were linked to somehow be associated with the international jihadist movement. The Islamist, to use the sort of
mm-hmm.
French term. And I found that very dangerous because I think that at an international level, when people see this kind of thing playing out, the perception that it is giving is that these students were somehow engaged with political Islam on a front that I think, based on the discussions I've had with a couple of the students,
mm-hmm.
no longer students, young lawyers, is just simply inaccurate. And I think what that does is it links an attempt by an equality-seeking group to somehow allow itself to be characterized and marginalized and perceived in the public eye as being a terrorist group.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is dangerous because what it does is it allows an alarmist and the British Columbia Human Rights Tribunal and the Ontario Human Rights Commission and the investigators' report on the Canadian Human Rights Commission all characterized Stein's writings variously as inaccurate, fear-mongering at best, lacking objectivity, lacking any attempt to, from a journalistic perspective, present the facts without a sort of underlying political spin. So, these are things that came out of decision makers who are legally based, and Stein and McLean may not want to accept those views, but they have been trying to propagate that view internationally. I think the only place internationally where there's been a taker on that view has been in the United States, and that's in part because Stein and McLean have sort of media contacts, I think, in the U.S., and the result has been that there has been some pickup of this in the American media. Now, the kind of pickup, though, it's been, and I mentioned this in the article, is things like the August 4th Fox News presentation, where the person being interviewed as the spokesperson for free speech and freedom in Canada and supporting McLean and Mark Stein is Paul Frum. And Paul Frum, as you may know, is a well-known propagator of anti-Semitism, a former supporter of Zundel, and affiliated with white supremacist movement. Mm-hmm. So, you know, with friends like that, you don't need enemies. And I think that the in the long run, although they have succeeded, I think, in creating the most noise, I think this kind of association will damage them in the longer run.
Okay. Well, great. I don't want to take up too much of your time, so thank you very much for speaking with us today, and all the best with your future travels.
It's a pleasure. Thank you so much for calling.
That was Montreal-based human rights lawyer Pearl Eliadis. For some additional perspective on how human rights commissions work, Omar also spoke to Donna Seal. Seal is an Osgoode Hall graduate who formerly worked as co-counsel for the Manitoba Human Rights Commission. Currently, she runs a consulting company that offers education sessions for employers on human rights issues relating to the workplace.
It does sound like you have quite a bit of background in human rights law. Maybe you can share with us what your take is in terms of some of the current controversies regarding human rights tribunals.
There's quite a bit of misinformation, I think, as to what human rights commissions in fact do. And it's also important to, I think there's also a misunderstanding as to the different roles that commissions play as opposed to human rights tribunals, which are arms that are separate and distinct from human rights commissions.
Mm-hmm.
Human rights commissions are primarily, with the exception of some of the provinces like British Columbia and Ontario now, who have gone to a direct tribunal model, the provinces that still maintain human rights commissions, the commissions act as gatekeepers. They take in complaints and they work through the commission system. And if there is sufficient evidence for the matter to proceed to a tribunal, then that complaint will go forward. But for the most part, complaints are dealt with on an informal basis by commissions. And certainly from my experience with the Manitoba Human Rights Commission, they strive to try and resolve complaints because they see that it is a far more advantageous situation for the parties to resolve the matter rather than proceeding to an expensive and often time-consuming and not necessarily satisfying hearing before the Human Rights Tribunal.
Sorry, if I understand you correctly, then you're suggesting that the lack of formality actually is one of the strengths of the Human Rights Commissions because they allow problems to be solved quickly. Is that correct?
Certainly, I can only speak from the position of the Manitoba Human Rights Commission, but typically very, very few complaints that come before the Manitoba Manitoba Human Rights Commission's attention ever make it to tribunal. The very, very few. The vast majority either are dismissed for insufficient evidence or they're otherwise resolved between the parties. And there are stages from the very beginning when a call is made to the Manitoba Commission indicating there's a potential complaint. They have a pre-complaint process where the parties are approached before a complaint is even filed to see if it can be resolved. Because if the more you get involved in the process, the more entrenched typically people's positions become. And the potential for resolution isn't as great. So certainly the Manitoba Human Rights Commission takes a very proactive approach to try and resolve things very quickly between the parties.
Okay. And you said there's a lot of misinformation currently. I mean, one of the concerns is that the Human Rights Commissions are creating a chilling effect or acting as sort of like inquisition to go after political correctness. Would that be a fair assessment in your estimation?
I don't think so. I don't see any commission out there trying to get anyone. And certainly coming from Manitoba, these aren't the kind of issues when we're talking about hate speech issues. These aren't issues that typically come before the commission. Certainly during the time period that I worked with the commission, I recall perhaps one complaint that could be classified as a hate speech related complaint, and it again did not proceed to a tribunal, and I can't honestly recall the outcome. These aren't the types of complaints that on a daily basis certainly provincial commissions are dealing with. Mm-hmm. They're dealing primarily with complaints of discrimination in employment, services, and housing. You don't often see, so as I said, in the space of time I was there from 96 to 2003, again, I could count maybe one, maybe two complaints that ever broached this kind of topic.
Okay, so definitely sounds like the type of things that we're hearing in the media these days are maybe being blown out of proportion.
I think that there is certainly more being made of it than really on a practical basis is dealt with from the perspective of commissions. And even I think the Canadian Commission, although they have the provision that enables them to deal with hate speech on the internet, for example, I would hazard a guess that it is still a minute amount of what they deal with on a daily basis. That the majority of the complaints they're dealing with fall in most commissions are dealing with employment discrimination based complaints. That's the majority of what they see, and then there'll be services and housing related complaints. But I would strongly suggest that the vast majority of commissions across the country are not dealing with these kinds of issues on a daily basis.
Okay. And so in your overall estimation then, do you still think that human rights commissions in Canada are working to a more progressive, inclusive, a better society?
Absolutely. I think certainly the call that I've seen be made that the commission should be abolished as they do no good, I take a position strongly against that. And you could say, well, yes, of course you will say that because this is the area you work in and you still maintain a connection with the Human Rights Commission. You know, I've made that disclosure. Mm-hmm. But I would give up the work I do tomorrow if I thought that there was no role to play.
Okay.
But there is. I started my company because I saw that there was a need for people to understand what their human rights obligations were and that there's confusion out there. And that commissions are still, their primary role is education-based to try and get the information out there as to what is appropriate and what is not under the Human Rights Code. And I still say that there's a definite role for that.
And it sounds like a great deal of the role that you play is also educational. Now, you have a website. Maybe you wanted to share a little bit about, first of all, the web address and what you do there as well.
My weblog is at www.donnaseal.ca. And it's called Human Rights in the Workplace. And I blog, I try to do it once a week. Just on issues that I think of are importance to employers, employees, unions, any person that's involved in the workplace community. And my primary role is educational. That's what I think is the most important facet of what I do, is to try and teach and get employers and employees to understand what their respective roles are in the workplace relating to human rights law obligations, because it's not a one-sided issue. This isn't just all employers. Employees have obligations as well.
Okay.
And that if everybody understands what their roles are, that then the conflict would be reduced and human rights commissions won't have to get involved.
Can you give us, perhaps, Donna, an example of an obligation that employees have, just so our listeners can better understand what that entails?
Sure. The primary example, I think, would be in the area of the accommodation, the duty to accommodate. Employers have an obligation to accommodate the special needs of their employees. Disability is usually the big one.
Mm-hmm.
But that being said, employees also have a role to assist in the accommodation process. It's not a one-way street. An employee can't just drop a request for accommodation at the feet of an employer and say, you figure out things for me. An employee has to assist in that process so that the employer and employee are working together to find the best fit for both the employer and employee and to address the accommodation need of the employee.
Okay. So it's definitely not as adversarial, perhaps, as many of us would think otherwise.
I certainly don't advocate that. That doesn't resolve anything. I think if both employers and employees, or even if we move outside of the employment context and look at services and housing, if we work together and try and understand the roles of each other and how we can best address human rights issues in all of those areas, that's the way to go. And I see, in my view, certainly working at the Manitoba Commission and the general discussions I've had with commission counsel across the country, I see that's the role that commissions are taking. They're trying to get people to understand and resolve their issues as opposed to trying to get at people and trying to take an adversarial approach.
Well, you know, I think if we took that philosophy generally in life, working together to overcome these hurdles, I think we would just have a better society generally. So I think we can learn from that philosophy just even outside of the context of employment or in tenants. So thank you for that, and thank you very much for speaking to us today.
You're welcome.
That was Omar Haredi interviewing Donna Seal. Well, that's all the time we have for today's show. Of course, you can always leave your feedback in comment form at www.lawiscool.com. And make sure that you never miss a show by subscribing to our podcast using whatever newfangled technology it is that the kids are using these days. For Law is Cool, I'm Devin Johnston.